Today, we have Kyle Wilson, longtime marketing superstar of such legends as Jim Rohn, Brian Tracy, Zig Ziglar, and Dennis Waitley, as well as founder of Jim Rohn International and YourSuccessStore.com. Interviewing longtime friend, colleague, and publisher of Success Magazine, Darren Hardy. In part one of this powerful interview, Darren shares the distinctions and ideas he has gleaned from thousands of hours spent with some of the best marketing and success thought leaders in the world, including personal interviews and conversations with icons such as Steve Jobs, Warren Buffett, Jim Rohn, Maria Shriver, and Paul J. Meyer. Darren also shares the secrets of how companies like Apple, Nike, Starbucks, and Harley-Davidson create cult-like followings and the strategic process of turning customers into raving fans and then converting those fans into passionate and loyal advocates. Enjoy.
Today, I'm excited to have longtime friend and colleague and publisher of Success Magazine, Darren Hardy. Darren, welcome.
Kyle, great to be with you.
Hey, I guess we go way back, Darren. It's been, 20 years of collaborating and working together and doing some really exciting things. I really appreciate you joining me today.
Yeah, my pleasure, Kyle. I'm happy to do it.
So 5 years now as publisher of Success Magazine?
Yep, it'll be 5 years in September. Been an amazing journey, I'll tell you that.
I know you get to interview so many intriguing and great stories, CEOs and entrepreneurs and marketing legends. Are there a few that really stick out to you?
Yeah, some would be unexpected and then some I think would be expected. The first and the one that probably stands out the most is a guy by the name of Louis Zamperini. And Louis is a World War II POW, former Olympic athlete, and a true American hero. He's also the guy who was the story of Laura Hillebrand's book called Unbroken. And if you remember, Laura Hillebrand wrote Seabiscuit. Anyway, this guy, when I interviewed him, Kyle, was 94 years old and still had the virility and fortitude of attitude and mindset like nobody you've ever met. And he went through some of the most incredible atrocities. It would be unimaginable. There's the conclusion of our talk. I knew that there's no way I could have done what he did, have withstood the pain and suffering that he went through. I mean, this is the guy that was, abandoned on a raft for 47 days, lost at sea. In order to survive, he had to actually pull sharks out of the ocean with his bare hands, beat them with his fist, and then tear out their liver to eat in order to survive.
Or wow.
catch an albatross that landed on their raft and kill it and then tear out its breast meat to eat to survive, and then got captured by the Japanese and was beaten brutally in their prison camps, and to this day has incredible, unshakable attitude and will to be great. So he just had an indelible impression on me. And whenever I think I'm having a bad day, I have to go back to I'm not being Japanese war camp or having to pull 4 sharks out of the ocean and beat him with my bare fist. So life is pretty good, right?
Absolutely.
And then of course, Joern Mai's mentor, certainly one of the most impressionable interviews that I had at Success, was actually my very first interview ever as publisher of Success Magazine, and that is when I got a chance to interview Jim Rohn for the CD that goes in every issue of Success. And, the book that I wrote, The Compound Effect, is dedicated to Jim. I mean, there's been nobody in my life that has had more influence on my life besides my own father than Jim Rohn. So that would be another favorite interview, of course. And then the third, another guy that has been a mentor of mine, and the ability to interview him and present him to the rest of the Success audience was an honor and a privilege. And what he says in that interview is just incredible, particularly about his relationship with his wife, Jane. And, of course, I'm talking about Paul J. Meyer, who was the founder of Success Motivation Institute, kind of what I would consider more of the contemporary godfather to the personal development industry, having sold more than, I think, $2 billion, if not $3 billion to this day, personal development materials. So kind of really put the industry on the map. And so, then there's Maria Shriver, who was a legendary is a legendary figure from what we would consider the closest thing to American royalty, and her talking about what the definition of success is to her had a big impact on me at the time that I was interviewing her. And then one of my favorite characters on the planet is Richard Branson, and just some of the things that came up during our time together and the several times that I've had a chance to spend time with him since has left an indelible impressions on kind of how I work, operate, and how I pursue entrepreneurship and how I manage my time and productivity. And so those are some of my favorite personalities and people that I've had a chance to spend time with, meet, and present inside of Success.
Wow. You know, and what an honor to get those opportunities. So I know you worked with Paul Meyer directly for a period of time, and I remember he had 41 companies. I don't know what the end number ended up being, but what are some of the takeaways from working with Paul, some of the management lessons or leadership lessons?
Well, Paul just, you know, he was the guy that coined the phrase, attitude is everything. And it wasn't just the guy that talks about it. He lived it. I mean, whenever he walked into a room, he took over the room with his energy and his enthusiasm and his audacity of ambition. I mean, there was no goal too big. There was no obstacle too big. And, you know, Paul just had this belief. He'd say whenever he would enter into a business or a home where he was there to prospect, he just imagined that there was a red carpet rolled out and there was trumpeters, and the guy just couldn't wait to do business with him and couldn't wait to be his friend. I mean, that was just the expectation
wow.
that he had set about every encounter he was going to have, whatever might consider to be a frightening or fearful prospecting experience, right? So he just had this incredible attitude about everything. And as a result of that attitude and expectation, the world sort of organized itself in alignment with that for Paul, which is the reason why it seemed that everything he did, you know, turned to gold. But one of the secrets, or let's just say the little known facts when you sort of study his story, because his story is so incredible in terms of all the things that he accomplished. Just as a side note, I remember going to his funeral when they were just playing sort of the highlights of from various aspects of his life. And I remember sitting there, and the impression that I got was like, holy crud, I really need to speed it up. I need to go and start doing some stuff, because this guy just fits 10 lifetimes into one lifetime. I mean, the number of things that he did and accomplished in his lifetime was just extraordinary. A diversity of experiences, too. It wasn't like just one linear. He just did great in business. I mean, he had greatness in so many aspects of his life, even when it just came to adventure and fun. So, you know, that was sort of the big impression that I took from Paul and working with him, is just this insatiable desire to grow and improve and to experience and to sort of look at life as some, you know, grand adventure. And so that's sort of my experience working with Paul. He just sort of raised your level of ambition. You know, I remember spending time with him in one afternoon, and it was just like a four-hour stint. And after the end of the 4 hours, I felt like I needed to take a nap. He just wore me out mentally and emotionally and spiritually. I mean, he was so energizing that, or let's just say his energy was so bold and magnifying that when, you know, when he left, you needed to rest. It was so, you know, that was sort of the visceral impact that he would have on you just being around
him. I remember we went together to the funeral. You and Georgia and Steve and Jana and myself drove from our home and to Waco. And I remember when we came back, we opened up a bottle of champagne and celebrated, you know, our time with Paul and having known him and just his incredible life. And you're right, the funeral really did raise the bar, because I remember Jim passed away a year later, and it really made me think of how we should honor Jim in a similar way to how Paul was honored.
Which was extraordinary, because you really championed that whole thing and the tribute event that essentially you helped orchestrate with the support of Success and Video Plus. But you orchestrated was you know, where Tony Robbins was there and Brian Tracy and Dennis Whately and all these incredible legendary figures of personal development were organized to come and really celebrate Jim's life. And that I forgot that sort of the thing that inspired that was our collective experience having gone to Paul J. Meyer's funeral the year before. So
It really did. I remember spending a couple of days with Paul 5 or 6 years, might have been 10 years previous to that. And you're so right. It so raised the bar of my thinking. And I remember being so impressed by his conference room, which had his library of, what, 5 or 10,000 books all organized. It was an incredible experience where I've always set that as a goal, to have to have a room like that where your library is surrounding you. And then I remember a week later, after having met with Paul, he sent me a leather-bound prayer journal, personalized with my name on it, that he had, it was pretty remarkable that he had put that together. You meet people like Paul who are extremely shrewd. They're very good businessmen, and you don't always know the backstory of how much money they give away and the people that they help.
Right.
And, of course, Jim Rohn, what are a couple of takeaways from Jim that stand out in your mind?
Well, I remember I tell the story of when I first met Jim, and really the story is that it was a chilly day in Dallas, and I walked into a hotel, and I was actually there to meet you, Kyle. And the event was still going on, and so you weren't available until the event was over, so I sat in the back of the room, and this slight, wispy, white-haired guy, glasses dangling out of one hand and his crooked finger pointed up at the ceiling in another, with this wry look on his face, I remember the question that he asked the audience, and that was the pivotal defining question. He said, "How many of you want to have more?" And I thought, "Yeah, I want to have more." I didn't raise my hand, right? Cause I had my arms crossed, you know, and I'm in the back of the room waiting for this thing to be over. But inside, I'm like, "Yeah, I want to have more. I want to have more money, a big, better business, better body, more relationships, what have you." And at that point in my life, I had achieved a pretty good level of success, particularly for my age, because I was only 23 years of age at the time. But I'd done it by brute force. You know, I just outworked, out-prospected, out-failed, got out-rejected, and just did it by doing. So when he said, "How many want to have more?" I thought, okay, tell me what I got to do. Same time, I was thinking, I can't do anymore. I mean, I'm doing myself to death. I'm working 16, sometimes 18 hours a day through the weekends. You know, it's impossible for me to do anymore, but I have bigger goals than I'm able to achieve right now. And that's when Jim said, you know, if you want to have more, you have to become more. Success is not something you pursue. What you pursue eludes you. It could be like chasing butterflies. Success is something you become. Success is something you attract by the person you become. And that twist of logic, or that twist of philosophy, that twist of understanding changed everything for me. And so he went on to explain, you know, what it is to take an inventory of who you need to become in order to achieve what it is that you want. And I walked away from that and started to write down, okay, if this is what I want to achieve, then who do I need to become in order to achieve that? And I'm telling you, the path to the pot of gold at the end of the rainbow opened up. I mean, it became clear about what it is that I needed to become in order to achieve what it is that I wanted. And that was the beginning of my, I would say, tutelage with Jim. And that's when I really, you know, got a chance to work with him a lot through the endeavors that now the three of us were working on together. And then also just in the study of all his materials, as you know, being friends with you, I was able to access all of Jim's materials, which was published and which was not published. And I just consumed it morning, noon, and night as often as I could, and spent what would be a total of thousands of hours under the direct study of Jim. And that's, you know, how he had an impact, not just on sort of the tactics of how to become successful, but under the underlying philosophies of not only how to become successful, but how to live, you know, how to have, as the title of one of his programs is, an extraordinary lifestyle, you know, the art of exceptional living. And so, you know, that means that the impact was deep and indelible.
And I remember it was probably 1994, right, when you first saw Jim, the experience you're describing. And yes, I remember you. I remember you were this young hotshot real estate guy, and just seeing the transformation you really did make, and embracing the philosophy of what Jim was talking about, success, but going about it a different way. Jim would talk about in some of his really old CDs, he had one called How to Kick the Worry Habit, and he had all these different things he would talk about that had happened 20, 30 years before the Jim Rohn I knew. And it never made sense to me because I never could connect those two dots because of the person he had become. But he, you know, just his lifestyle, his approach to everything. I can think of some things that would happen that I thought it was the end of the world. You know, it would be a seminar and the hotel didn't have the room set up and I had people waiting and I'd be freaking out. And I'd go tell him and he'd say, hey, it's not like a good friend died. Yeah. It's going to be okay. You know, just his approach was remarkable.
Yeah, and I like that. I'm gonna remember that. You know, when something happens, it's not like a good friend died. Sentence, and one sentence brings everything back down to its proper perspective. It's not like a good friend died. Yeah,
that's great. So Darren, over the past 20 years, I know your historical background and all the different things you've been involved in and the successes you've had and the people you've worked with. Being publisher of success, you have the opportunity to see how so many other companies are doing and businesses are doing. You get to peek inside, if you will. You know, what would you say are some of the three or four distinctions of why certain companies succeed and others don't, or some succeed better than other companies?
Yeah, you know, there's a quote that the new CEO of Yahoo put out on his investor call a couple of days ago. It was reported in the news this morning. And I think this is one of the big, big distinctions. And he said, we must get clearer on what we don't do. And I think that's the big challenge of lots of business owners is that we don't lack for opportunity. I mean, opportunity and the new idea and the shiny objects and the distractions are constantly around us. And that's not the success path is trying to find what the next idea is. In fact, the success path is staying focused on what it is that is your core objective. So I remember when I got a chance to spend some time with Steve Jobs, I asked him, what is it that you're most proud of that you or that Apple has created, has built? And his answer was right to this point. He said, I'm as proud of what we don't do as I am of what we do. And I thought, wow, of all the incredible revolutionary things that they have produced, he's more proud of what they haven't produced, saying no to, than what they have produced. And this is followed on. One of my colleagues, the editor-in-chief of Fast Company, was interviewing Mark Parker, who at that time became the new CEO of Nike. And Mark was talking about a conversation that he had with Steve Jobs on the phone when he first took the job, and he'd asked Steve, do you have any advice for me taking over Nike as the new CEO? And at first he said no, and then he says, oh, I do have one piece of advice. He said, you know, Nike makes some of the best, most revolutionary products that you lust after. He said, but you also make a lot of crap. he said, just stop making the crap so that you can focus on the stuff that is extraordinary. And Mark really took that to heart. And that was one of the first things he did when he became the new CEO, is that he shut down a lot of the things that Nike was doing that wasn't extraordinary, so that they could take the time, energy, money, and resources to focus on the things that they could be extraordinary at. And this is also followed up by some time that I spent with Warren Buffett, and I asked Warren this question. I said, what do you think is the key to your great success? Now, you know, Warren is a financial guru. He's called the Oracle of Omaha. I mean, one of the smartest, certainly one of the most wealthy people in human history. He's worth $50 billion. How many answers could he have to that question? You know, and he's got it down to one answer. He gives it in all his press, you know, press ask him all the time. Investors, his stockholder meetings are asking him all the time, and this is his answer, which is an important answer if you're asking the guy who's got $50 billion of net worth. He said, key to success is, for every 100 great opportunities that are brought to me, I say no 99 times. Now, that's not just investment opportunities. That's solicitations of his time or his attention, you know, whether it's to do an interview or take a meeting or to be on a conference call or whatever, of 100 opportunities that are presented to him, his discipline is to say no 99 times. And so that's one of the great, great distinctions about having a company end up becoming excellent. It's like, you know, you want to be world-class at a few things instead of mediocre at many things. And that's the challenge for a lot of organizations is what are the few things that you want to be world-class at? And then the temptation that you will have to become extraordinarily disciplined at is saying no and weeding out everything else along your path to becoming world-class at those few things. So that's one of the great distinctions. And then probably playing into this conversation, Kyle, I'll mention this, that if you're going to become great at one of a few variables, let me give you a few options. You know, rather be best in management. Would you rather have the best management team you possibly could hire? Like, you got the AA talent. Or would you rather have the best margins, where when your product is sold, it's richly profitable? Or would you rather have the best marketing? Or would you rather have the best product? I mean, the one that is the first in class in your entire category. Of those four options, which would you rather have and be best at? Well, a lot of people will say, well, I want the best product. If I got the best product, then I'll be the winner in the marketplace. Well, we know that that's not true, because if you ask yourself the question, what's the number one restaurant in the world? It's not the one that has the best product, the best food, because the number one restaurant in the world is McDonald's. What's the number one wine in the world? I mean, you got all these incredible, you know, wineries and all this history and all this foo-foo-ness that goes around and surrounds the snobbiness of creating the best wine, yet the number one wine in the world is Franzia. It comes in a box. Or how about management? You know, the next assumption is management makes a competitive difference. I mean, there are countless dream teams that have failed miserably. I mean, think of Enron, or think of the movie Ocean's 13, or the 2004 Olympic basketball team that was comprised of nothing but NBA stars that ended up third, losing to Lithuania, for crying out loud. So it's not management. Margins, you know, certainly your accountant or CFO wish that it had the best margins, but we all know that margins don't matter if nothing ever sells. Ultimately, like it or not, the one thing that matters the most in determining whether your business succeeds or fails is marketing. As Dan Kennedy said, vast, gigantic leaps come from only one place, sales and marketing. So the person who knows how to get, keep, and cultivate a customer is the one who gets paid the most, period. I consult for a lot of high-level organizations, and I'll go in there, and my fee on a per-hour basis is sometimes 5-10 times that of the CEO. Why? Because I'm bringing the missing ingredient to this high-level organization. As I said, I'm the one that knows how to get, keep, and cultivate a customer, and that's the one who ends up getting paid the most. So the formula, Kyle, a lot of organizations have is they spend 90% of their time and energy focused on developing a really great product. And that's where all their R&D is, and that's where a lot of their resources are there to support, and they spend 10% on marketing. And it's, in fact, the opposite equation. Spend 10%, yes, you have to have a good product. It doesn't have to be the best product. I mean, look at Danzia or Polar Springs. These are bottled water companies, right? You know, those are the top two bottled water companies in the world, and yet you've got Fuji and Avion and all these smart waters and all the rest of those, and they're sucking wind by comparison. So instead, spend 10% developing a great product and 90% on marketing, improving, iterating your marketing, studying, tweaking, looking at the metrics, working on your messaging. You know, if you want to hire consultants, you want to hire advisors, you want to take training and get education, the place to get it is in the area of sales and marketing, because that's ultimately going to make the difference of whether your organization succeeds in a substantial way over your competition is going to be in the area of marketing. So that would be my answer there.
Wow, that's excellent. And I would add the word strategic marketing. I've seen a lot of companies spend a lot of money, right? And it's just not strategic in the thinking of how they do it. And so that I'm glad you segued it into marketing, because when people think of you, they probably think of Darren, the speaker, the publisher, the author. And, you know, the Darren I know, I've seen you be highly successful both in technology and especially in the marketing side of companies. You've done some highly profitable ventures mixing those two pieces together. So, you know, marketing's changed the traditional interruption marketing now versus permission marketing. What would you say that successful marketers are doing better than their competition?
It's beyond permission marketing at this point as well. I mean, it's really about relationship cultivation. It's even beyond marketing, where it's your ability to create a tremendous amount of value that attracts customers, engages them deeply, and then continues to be the trusted resource for an ongoing experience, you know, lifetime value. And part of engaging this audience and having them become loyal followers is engaging them in a higher purpose. I mean, I teach strategies to business owners and high-level CEOs about how companies like Apple and Nike and Starbucks and Harley-Davidson create cult-like followings. I mean, these are organizations that have customer advocacy followings that are extraordinary. So the strategic process is how to turn customers into rabid fans. What's that process? And then how to turn rabid fans into passionate and loyal advocates. So it's furthermore then about positioning, it's about engaging, and it's about serving, and it's becoming the trusted resource for that as an organization, for that customer marketplace ongoing. And so there's a whole variety of strategies. There's a 12-point framework of how to become a high-performing, high-impact organization. And then there's six distinctions on how to develop this cult-like following, of passionate followers that become advocates for your brand. And we, having had a chance to spend time inside and studying the organizations of Apple and Nike and Starbucks, that's where a lot of that intel comes from.
Can you share a couple of those with us, the 12 and the 6?
Well, part of it is, first off, is finding a common purpose that you share with your customer audience, the target customer audience. And part of this is to have it be okay that you are going to eliminate some people. It's like Apple. They had no problem eliminating people who had PCs. Or, you know, I mean, I'm a Mac, I'm a PC. They had no problem insulting and isolating anybody that currently had a PC. And so then you find a higher purpose. So you saw Apple talk about the creative types that other people see crazy and they see brilliance. They see the people who have the ability to make a dent in the universe. So they created this higher purpose, this higher vision, think different. We're here to make a dent in the universe. Steve Jobs said specifically, you know, people are attracted to vision. Put a dent in the universe attracted like-minded people who shared that vision, and that became our advantage. You see Nike do this with a lot of their commercials that inspire you to and give credence to the athletes, to the one that just does and doesn't give up and so forth. And, you know, then you also see Apple create an identity that makes their community able to sort of show off by having and holding an iPhone and having the white earbud, having the Apple be right side up when your laptop is flipped up and so forth. So, you know, and then also taking a position, taking a stand, having a point of view. It could be even polarizing. Sometimes polarizing is even better. You know, the old adage is it's better to be loved or hated than it is to be tolerated or simply ignored. You know, it's aspects of elevating your tribe, your community, inspiring them, challenging them. And, you know, and then, so there's that, those aspects. I know that I sit on the board of Invisible Children, and they came out with that movie, Kony 2012. And a lot of people thought this is sort of this one hit wonder, this overnight sensation. What they don't know is that organization's been around for 7 years. And they had, that was the 24th video that they had ever put out there. And over the last year, year and a half, I'd watched, as I said on the board, and they'd kind of lost their way a little bit, where they were focusing their commentary on kind of what was going on the ground in Uganda and the political process that was happening in Washington, D.C. to try to get this bill passed, to get the United States more actively engaged. And I said, look, the reason why people joined the following of this organization to begin with is because they fell in love with the three founders, the three guys that were behind this organization that had this passion to make a difference for what they saw firsthand as atrocities in northern Uganda when they had been there. And so there's almost like a three-part formula. Number one is that your tribe will first fall in love with you. You are what they first identify themselves with, either want to be like, or are attracted to. And then when they fall in love with you, they fall in love with your passion. Your passion becomes their passion. And then the third thing is once they fall in love with you and they fall in love with your passion and your purpose, they'll do what you ask them to do. So if you really want to build this cult-like following, you'll notice that anybody who's built these cult-like followings, there's been a person that has spearheaded it, that has raised the level of ambition for the tribe, that has challenged them, that has elevated them, that has enrolled them, and through their passion, the tribe has fallen in love with their passion. And then once they do that, they do what you ask. They march on your command. They follow your lead. And so that's, you know, there's certainly a deeper discussion about the aspects of each one of those components, but those are just some highlights on kind of what the process is, that a lot of the most revered and loved brands and organizations on this planet, the specific tactics they employ to actually create that outcome of loyal, rabid fan-like followings. Those things don't happen by accident. They're very, very strategic about how the process of enrolling and engaging and keeping and activating and mobilizing a fan following, how that process works.
This concludes part one of this powerful interview. We will send part two by email in the next few days. If you encounter any challenges, don't receive part two, or want to share this interview, simply email us at info@kylewilson.com with Darren Hardy interview part two as the subject, and we'll be happy to send it to you. To connect with Darren Hardy, go to http://darrenhardy.success.com. Or with Kyle Wilson, go to kylewilson.com.